Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program heard weekdays on 18 radio stations with 27 signals all across the Treasure State. Thanks for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook at Voices of Montana and on the internet at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com.
Terrorism, we hear that word an awful lot. I wonder if it's a word we've grown too comfortable with. I mean, we have a war on terror, and the country declared that after 9/11, 2001, right? And the big question then is still kind of the big question now. Can we win a war on terror, or how do you win a war on terror? Today, we explore that question with the perspective of a very familiar geopolitical front in Gaza. Once again, it's inflamed. Co-host Bill Whitsitt joins us as we welcome the insights of one of the world's leading experts on global security and terrorism, Georgetown University professor Dr. Bruce Hoffman, today on Voices of Montana.
If you're working without safety, you might as well be naked.
Oh, Gary. Yeah, he wears steel-toed boots, but that's pretty much it.
I mean, a safety vest would at least be a start.
Don't expose yourself.
He gets out the sander and I can't watch.
Or your coworkers. Cover up with safety expertise from Montana State Fund, Montana's first choice for workers' comp insurance. Learn more at safemt.com. Workplace safety. You're naked without it.
Very special program here today, and I'm going to welcome a co-host, Bill Whitsitt. We've known him as a former committee chair for the USS Montana Committee, and then also Bill with a doctor of philosophy in public administration from George Washington University. Lots of insights from this gentleman. We appreciated speaking with him from Tel Aviv there in Israel as that Hamas attack again occurred. And Bill, thank you again for being here. I appreciate that. I'm very excited to meet the acquaintance of Bruce Hoffman. Why don't you tell me about your colleague?
Well, a fine person. Dr. Bruce Hoffman, a former neighbor of mine in the Washington, D.C. area, and anyone who studies terrorism and certainly those who seek to combat terrorism knows Bruce Hoffman's name, probably has heard him speak and read a lot of his writings, because he's been studying terrorism and insurgency for 5 decades or more, I think. And as you mentioned, a professor at Georgetown University. He's also the chairman of the Jewish Civilization Center at George Washington and the graduate level Center for Security Studies and Security Studies Master of Arts program there. But even more importantly, he was a member of the FBI 9/11 Review Commission and has been appointed by the governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, who's been in the news a lot recently as a commissioner on the Commonwealth of Virginia's Commission to Combat Anti-Semitism, a scholar in residence for counterterrorism at the Central Intelligence Agency. He was actually awarded by the director of Central Intelligence the SEAL medallion, the highest level of commendation given to a non-government employee. And his books include Inside Terrorism, Anonymous Soldiers, and others. And so I'm just delighted to be able to have us visit a little bit with Bruce. And I'd like to say welcome, Bruce.
Well, thanks very much, Bill, especially for that kind introduction. And thank you very much, Tom, for having me on your show.
Oh, I appreciate you being here. And Bill barely got into the qualifications here as well. Bruce, I'm just going to start. Of course, we're probably going to ask this question over and over because I'm not sure we're going to get a satisfactory answer. And maybe you haven't in 2+ decades of studying this. But let's start with that big question, a war on terror. Can it be won? And how can it be won?
Well, Tom, you've kind of hit the nail on the head when you said a war on terror. And I think that was the biggest mistake the United States made 22 years ago, although not probably in the way you're thinking I'm going to answer it or perhaps your listeners. I mean, I think we needed to go after Al-Qaeda and destroy them, which unfortunately we did not succeed in doing. So that's not my issue. My issue is that we called it a war on terror, and that was the big mistake because terror is an emotion. And that's something that scares us, that creates anxiety. And that's what terrorists are always trying to do. That's their stock in trade, is to use violence to create fear and anxiety. So I think we then lost sight of what the target and the mission was after 9/11, which should have been destroying Al-Qaeda. And we got diverted, and you know the rest, as they say, is history. If we had declared a war on terrorism, the ism is enormously important because that means that it's political. And that means the people perpetrating it have chosen to turn their back on Western liberal democratic values and instead to impose their will, which we call authoritarianism or totalitarianism. And I think then we would have focused it on the group that was responsible for 9/11, and we might have had a better outcome. But I think the problem is that we pivoted from Afghanistan very early in our engagement there, exactly when we were succeeding. For a variety of reasons, we decided to invade Iraq. I mean, it wasn't just the United States that had flawed intelligence. All of our Western allies, NATO, also had similarly flawed intelligence, so everybody believed it to be true. But that diversion, I think, robbed us of the opportunity to have eliminated the threat from al-Qaeda, because we were doing extremely well in Afghanistan. And I was there on U.S. government business in 2008, so that was already 7 years later. And, you know, the dominant theme that I heard from talking to our military there is that Afghanistan's like the war in the Pacific during World War II, that once Hitler's defeated and Nazi Germany is defeated, then the attention will focus on Afghanistan. And that happened, of course, about 2 years later with the surge. But by then it was too late. And also, we telegraphed our punch. We said we were surging but leaving. So the Taliban understood they just had to wait us out. And that, to me, connects with the current crisis in Gaza and Israel. It's because the Taliban boasted after the U.S. withdrew that persistence and perseverance will eventually triumph. And in fact, Hamas was one of the groups that applauded that and embraced that. And we see that this is their game as well. That our, and it's not just Hamas, it's that our terrorist enemies seek to enmesh us in these prolonged wars of attrition that they hope eventually will tire from.
So, Bruce, let me follow up on your comments that you made there. And in a little bit, I know we're going to want to get into the philosophy behind Hamas and Hezbollah and others. But in terms of the war on terror comments, are the Israelis doing the right things in your mind right now when they are talking about eliminating Hamas? And is that possible?
Well, I think it is possible. There has to, I mean, Sri Lanka in 2009 eliminated the Tamil Tigers, which had been engaged in a terrorist campaign against the government there for, you know, a quarter of a century. It requires incredible ruthlessness and focus. I mean, the Sri Lankans killed an estimated, you know, at least 20,000 and perhaps as many as 40,000 civilians in their push to destroy the Tigers. But in the end, they killed the leader. They killed all of his senior lieutenants. They killed almost every single fighter. And there's no terrorism in Sri Lanka. So it's possible to do that. I think it can be done without the ruthlessness. And what we're seeing now in Gaza, I believe, is firstly, Israel giving as much scope as possible for negotiations to free as many hostages as possible, but I suspect it's the dribs and drabs we've seen over the past 4 or 5 days or so isn't going to turn into any kind of a spigot. It'll be the same sort of thing as Hamas is trying to ward off the assault that they know is inevitable, because they know that Israel is intent on damaging them, and especially given the tragedy that occurred on October 7th, that I think one of the reasons that Israel has not gone in immediately is that, look, armies can't fight without intelligence. I mean, that's the bottom line. I think Israel is attempting to the greatest extent possible to develop the targeting packages and the specific missions of their troops so as to avoid to the greatest extent possible civilian casualties, but also to be as effective as possible. So eliminating a group completely is impossible, because in Hamas's case, the military wing, of course, that kind of runs the show, really, as we've seen, is in Gaza. The political wing, you know, living in palatial places in Doha, in Qatar, and other places, you know, in living in Damascus, Syria, rather comfortably. So it's not going to be – what Israel is intent on doing is eliminating Hamas's military capability, and I think that's entirely possible.
And I want to ask a question here, if I may, and it deals with this. Are there are we fighting two different wars? Is Israel fighting a war against Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran by proxy? And the U.S. is fighting this war on terror, as you say. Does that complicate it? Are we looking for different outcomes here? How does that complicate an outcome?
Well, I mean, you're right. We were fighting different wars. And I think the U.S. war on terror basically ended when we, and even that term, ended when we left Afghanistan. And even before then, in January 2018, for example, the Defense Department announced a new defense policy, a national strategy, that very clearly stated that terrorism will no longer be our preeminent national security priority, that competition from peer rivals, China and to an extent Russia, although I wouldn't say it's a peer rival, but in other words, challenges from states were going to be privileged. I think what the United States is learning, especially from the events of October 7th, is that we have a waterfront of threats that we have to cover effectively. We can't privilege one over the other. We have to be flexible in how we allocate our resources because these threats are all enormously dynamic. They're always changing, so you can't be rigid. I mean, in part, I think Israel's rigidity got it into trouble on October 7th, that it was focused not on Gaza Strip but on the West Bank, for example. So I think this has been a wake-up call for the United States as well, and that our policy and strategy is going to change because I think the savagery and brutality of that attack, I think, underscores that terrorism is a threat that hasn't gone away, and that because the United States is the leader of the free world, I mean, year in, year out, since 1968, we've always been the number one terrorist target. We understand now that that's going to continue and that we have to be prepared so that we don't fall into the same trap the Israelis did on October 7th of thinking that terrorism, at least in Gaza, Hamas was in its box and was less of a threat and tragically learned otherwise.
Text message is open at 781-627-5483. 781-627-5483. You may have some questions as we approach this topic once again of terrorism. Is it terrorism all over again? New perspectives on it. And as we look back at this war on terror, Bill Whitsitt joins us. He's a guest host of the program and also a colleague of our current guest here, Professor Bruce Hoffman from the Center for Jewish Civilization and also Center for Security Studies, professor at Georgetown University. Bill and Bruce, again, thank you both for being here.
Sure. Thanks. And Bruce, let me ask you a couple of more questions about the current situation. I know it's fresh, it's raw. Having been in Tel Aviv when the attacks started, I can only imagine the grief that continues there. But in terms of what we know now about the actual attack, I know when we were there over the first few days, there was some question as to whether perhaps some of the terrorists were able to, whether by commandeering a vehicle or something, get to other parts of Israel. Is that pretty much gone away now, that there's a concern about whether there are lingering terrorists in parts of Israel?
I think at this stage, the Israel Defense Forces have reported that Israel is secure and they're satisfied. They've tracked down most of the people that crossed. I mean, don't forget the fence was breached in five places. And it wasn't only men, you know, wearing black fatigues with combat webbing and storming across. There were lots of people in leather jackets and just opportunists, let's say, criminals as well. I think Israel has now secured that border area, and that the concern of the border area is that when there is a ground invasion, that if any residents that remain in that area would be vulnerable to missile fire and just the spillover of the fighting from the Gaza Strip into Israel proper.
Well, I know there's going to be a lot of internal searching within Israel at the right time once there is time and ability to focus on it as to what may have happened in terms of the intelligence and all of that. And I'm sure we'll want to talk a little bit about how we have focused on fighting terrorism. But I guess one of the burning questions for me is, since it is so fresh and so raw,
Is there an overriding set of questions that you're getting from those in the, you know, three-letter agencies and those things at this early stage of having seen this attack that, that maybe people ought to be aware of? What is the principal immediate concern, do you think?
I think, at least in Washington, D.C., and probably elsewhere, too, the overriding concern is what's next? Not so much whether Israel is going to launch a ground invasion. You don't call 360,000 reservists to have them standing around the border indefinitely. I think it's a question of when, not if, they'll go in. But the biggest questions, I think, in Washington, D.C., in government circles and elsewhere, is what happens after that? I mean, will there be a second front war in Lebanon against Hezbollah? Will Hezbollah join in the conflict as it did in 2006 when a border war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza sparked a 34-day war and an Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon? Will unrest explode, for instance, in the West Bank, where there had been weeks or, in fact, months of unrest that had escalated in part over the Al-Aqsa Mosque and, you know, of course, the holy precinct, the Al-Haram al-Sharif, where Al-Aqsa Mosque is the third holiest shrine in Islam, is also sacred to Jews because that's the site of the first and second temples that were destroyed. So that had led to a rise in tensions, and it was probably why the Netanyahu government was very focused on security in East Jerusalem and the West Bank and perhaps not in Gaza. So there's every danger, I think, and this is the big worry now, that Israel could find itself in a three-front war and perhaps even with countries like Iran interceding as well.
Well, you have written about how the current situation and the attacks will change the Middle East. And certainly I think we can all imagine that if some of what you just described comes about, there is likelihood that balances will shift. And I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about that. This is such a terrible near-term issue that we've seen, problem, and yet the implications seem to be so far-reaching in that region, at least, and maybe in the world.
I think the biggest repercussion is the fact that no one will look at Iran in the same way again, even if they already had profound suspicions about Iran and Iran's bellicose intentions in the region, its attempt to mobilize all kinds of terrorists, not just Iran, of course, is a Shia country, which is one of the branches of Islam. Hamas and Palestine Islamic Jihad are Sunni, the dominant or the largest branch. The fact that Iran is making common cause with Hamas and Palestine Islamic Jihad, as well as Hezbollah in Lebanon, I think underscores its malignant intentions for the region, which it wants to dominate and eviscerate Western influence, much as Iran is ruled today, completely suppress any democratic expressions or expressions of self-determination amongst the peoples there, and impose their authoritarian will or dominance over the region. So I think that's going to be the biggest repercussion, is that any illusions about Iran and the danger of Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon are pretty obvious now, because Hamas and Palestine Islamic Jihad are bankrolled by Iran, according to the U.S. Department of State, to the tune of at minimum $100 million a year, which obviously goes into buying the armaments and the weaponry that we saw on display on October 7th. So that, to me, is the biggest negative, let's say, impact. I'm hoping that the biggest positive impact will be an understanding of really the malignancy of terrorism, and that terrorism, you know, these aren't freedom fighters, these aren't the resistance, that they savagely kill women and children and the elderly, that there'll be no more illusions, and that hopefully those who have been working so hard for peace, and I think one of the positive developments we see in the region now is not one of the four Muslim countries that signed the Abraham Accords, you know, the landmark diplomatic recognition of Israel. To date, at least, none of them have reneged. None of them have dropped out of that. So that's entirely positive, which gives me the hope that when this finally settles down, the terrorists will be marginalized, their state patron will be even more isolated, and hopefully we can get back to the business of building peace.
Interesting. Dr. Bruce Hoffman is with us here, professor at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service, also a known author as well, Inside Terrorism, now in its third edition, is cited as one of the 25 most notable books published by Columbia University Press. And also Bill Witsit is with us as well, special co-host for the program today. Go ahead, Bill.
I was just going to ask Bruce, too, about the timing of the October 7th attacks and all that has transpired since. You've written that the terror organizations, of course, for all the reasons you've already mentioned, but really are political. And Iran, it seems, had a huge stake in changing the dynamics currently, because it looked like there was more progress potentially to be made with Saudi Arabia and more normal relations perhaps with Israel. And could you address that and how all this timing sort of might fit together?
I think you're exactly right that just as the Middle East was poised on the precipice of really an historical development, which would have been Saudi Arabia, the defender of the faith, the country responsible for the defense and maintenance of Islam's two holiest shrines at Mecca and Medina, was prepared to recognize Israel diplomatically, and also the quid pro quo for that, because the United States was really overseeing that process, was a Saudi-U.S. defense pact. Well, this was completely anathema to Iran, because this would have isolated Iran in the region. So clearly that played a role. But don't forget, I mean, these attacks were really planned for months, if not for even, you know, over a year, perhaps 2 years, and probably coincide with the period when the Abraham Accords were spreading beyond the initial signatories, you know, in the United Arab Emirates, to Morocco, to Sudan, to Bahrain. So that was a significant threat. And I think at the end of the day, the principal enemies of terrorists everywhere are not their hardline opponents, but rather moderates and peacemakers or peace builders. They're the ones who threaten the terrorists most because they marginalize the terrorist extremism. So I think that as the Abraham Accords took hold, and part of the strategy or approach of the Abraham Accords is that Israel could make peace with many Muslim states, and that eventually the Palestinians would be the only ones left who hadn't made some sort of accommodation, and they would finally return to the negotiating table. Well, that strategy has clearly backfired. But I think at the same time, because the Palestinians obviously by this, well, or through Hamas, I should say, not the Palestinians, Hamas has, through October 7th, registered its veto of this. But I still think, as I said a moment ago, the positive thing is that the Abraham Accords have remained intact, that hopefully we can return to a time that's more propitious or more amenable to negotiations and for the progress that's already been achieved to be built upon further.
And I think it'll be interesting to hear your comments maybe after we come back from the next break about the role of an organization like Hamas that has had very clear comments in the past and formal policy statements that say that it is never going to be part of a solution that includes negotiation and compromise. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that. I know we've got a break coming up.
The fastest hour in Montana radio continues. Call 866-627-5483 and join Montana's statewide radio talk show, Voices of Montana with Tom Schultz.
High-level discussion today with terrorism expert Bruce Hoffman from Georgetown University, the Walsh School of Foreign Service, and a lot of experience in this field, nearly five decades of it. Again, one of the premier experts across the region. Number of books there. I'm looking forward to reading these. Bruce Hoffman again with us, part of the Hoffman Group. Maybe you can tell us what that is as well. Inside Terrorism, that's been in its third edition. We look at this war on terror. It started many, many years ago after 9/11. What have we learned? Where have we come? I got one of those text messages here, and it leads into what we're talking about. And again, I welcome you back here from Montana for Montana's Voices of Montana with Bruce Hoffman and our special guest co-host today, Bill Whitsitt, a friend of the program and nationally known figure as well. Actually, in Montana, formed and directed the Montana Television Network organization, and that's still going today. So, Bruce and Bill, thank you guys both for being here. I'll just lead into this, Bruce, as we left off with that sort of discussion, and it's in the form of this text message as well. How can we negotiate with a group that wants to annihilate Israel? I think that is a front and center question, isn't it?
I agree completely, and I think a lot of Israelis, and especially the Netanyahu government and others, are thinking about that, because the assumption in Israel was that, at least in recent years, Hamas was governing Gaza, and therefore that was their main preoccupation, and therefore they were hopefully thinking less about adhering to their covenant charter, which of course calls for the obliteration, and that's a word that they use in the covenant of Israel. But I think this is the point. I mean, you can negotiate with terrorists, as Israel has been doing and as the United States at times has done, for the release of hostages on a one-for-one individual basis. I think it's remarkably difficult to negotiate with terrorists if they persist in believing that they can only achieve their aims through armed force. And like Hamas, for a decade and a half now, Hamas has declared what they call hudnas, truces with Israel, which I think may have lulled certain Israelis, into a false sense of security, thinking, well, if they're declaring these truces, hopefully we can build upon this and perhaps engage in some resolution or at least some understanding of our differences. But that's the point. When you still have in your covenant, in your charter, when you have as your mission statement the obliteration of another state, I mean, you're right, there is no negotiation. And I think this has been a wake-up call, not just for Israel, but for other countries, that we have to take terrorists seriously at their word, that it's not just rhetoric designed to appeal to their base. They mean what they say. I mean, go back to the 1990s. In 1996 and 1998, Osama bin Laden declared war on the United States. And we all laughed, I mean, including myself. We thought, what is this one person with a ragtag group of followers going to do to the world's preeminent superpower? Well, I think just like the Israelis found out on October 7th, I mean, we were shocked and stunned and mortified by what happened on September 11th. And the trouble is, September 11th is now more than two decades ago. I'm teaching students who were born after 2001. They have no idea what it was like that day and what it was like in the aftermath and how fearful our country was. And that's why I would argue that terrorism, you know, it's perpetrated by non-state actors, so it's sometimes dismissed as having the repercussions that actual war has. But we've seen on October 7th and certainly on 9/11 that terrorism can have an enormous impact, and therefore we always have to be vigilant in defending against it, protecting ourselves from these threats, and as I said, taking terrorists seriously at their word, that they are committed to chaos and violence. I mean, that's their stock and trade.
Bruce, you know, I think I may have mentioned to you offline that 2 days before the October 7th attack, my wife and I were at the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem. And the guide spent a lot of time showing video clips and reminding the people there that in the 1930s, there was no secret that Hitler and others wanted to exterminate the Jewish race. And they made it very clear. And I remember her leaving us all with the question, are we seeing the same thing today? Mm-hmm. And 2 days later, we see these horrendous attacks by an organization that, as you have pointed out, has as its charter the very thing that was talked about by that guide that was public in the 1930s, and no one paid attention. Stunning to me.
No, you're absolutely right, Bill. We don't take people at their word, firstly. And secondly, I think from a Jewish perspective, October 7th was even more of a tragedy for the simple reason that more Jews were killed that day than on any single day since the Holocaust. So things that were thought to have been ancient history, or maybe not so ancient history, but relegated to a different era, certainly to a different century, we find have never completely gone away, and that those sentiments, tragically, are easily rekindled. And, you know, one has to say, too, that, you know, it's not just Hamas's depredations and the savagery and butchery that I think has shocked and stunned many people in the United States, certainly in Israel and in other places of the world, but it's been some of the things that we've seen on social media, which revel in the fact that babies, women, children, the elderly, the disabled, the infirm, were either butchered or dragged off in captivity, that make no distinction that it's innocent people suffering. Some of the media's reporting, for instance, that has taken whatever Hamas tells them and just run with it, such as last week's explosion at a hospital in Gaza, that within minutes of the explosion, Hamas was blaming Israel and saying 500 people had died. Whereas if you just step back and paused and said, how could they tally a death toll like that in just a few moments? But yet, every major media outlet, CNN, BBC, New York Times, I mean, they all rushed to basically, you know, validate Hamas's argument. And I noted a couple of days ago that when it became clear, so this was last Thursday or Friday, a day or two after the hospital, when it turned out it was a rocket fired by Palestine Islamic Jihad that fell short and landed in the parking lot, not even in the hospital. So all of this was, you know, a falsehood. But I noted that, for instance, you know, at least on the East Coast, you know, the papers, the newspapers of record are the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. The Wall Street Journal had it on its front page as the lead story that hospital attack proven not to be Israel. It was buried on page 9 of the New York Times. So that's the problem, is that that calumny had become fact for many people throughout the world. And, of course, there were very vociferous vocal denunciations of Israel. There were demonstrations. It inflamed opinion even more. And that's the problem. Once it's reported authoritatively by the media in this case, it's very hard to walk the cat back. So people now accept it as the truth. And it's, you know, at a time that we need to be reducing tensions, it's only heightened them and inflamed them.
And Bruce, let's talk for a minute about what we've seen on college campuses by the younger generations who have taken to streets, many of them. There have been some pro-Israel demonstrations, but clearly there's been a almost, I guess, worldwide increase in demonstrations in favor of the Palestinians and, as you say, in some respects celebrating the attacks of October 7th. I'm wondering how we even begin to help our country and help Western civilization cope with the leaps to what we're seeing by our younger generations, including students who are supposed to be at institutions of higher learning where they can actually pick through and reasonably talk about things like this instead of taking to the streets with some of the chants that we've seen. What's your thought about that?
You know, it's a great question. You know, obviously people are going to disagree on issues. They're going to have different perspectives. I understand that. There are people that believe Israel doesn't have a right to exist, which, of course, I disagree with. I think every people should have a right to self-determination. Israel is not a colonialist settler state. I mean, Jews were in Israel nearly 6,000 years ago. But I get all that. I think what has troubled me so much on our campuses and amongst faculty at various universities, one at Cornell, for instance, who described October 7th, the events that day, as exhilarating, is that they've lost their moral compass. I can understand you may not like Israel, you may loathe the current government, you may not like Israel's policies, you may think Israel has become a repressive country that persecutes the Palestinians. I understand that, and there's some validity to some of those arguments, although I think we always have to address these things in a very nuanced way. But I can't believe that you could have so many heartless people in this world that glorify killing of the innocent, whoever they are, whether they're Palestinians, Jews, anyone else, who adopt as their logos a terrorist on a paraglider, for example, that make no moral distinction between the wanton savagery and butchering of civilians and are prepared to accept it because these people happen to be a different religion, and that conflate to a religion with a nation. I mean, this is a complicated discussion, but I think, at least amongst Israelis and amongst many Jews, the argument that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism has really been challenged by these views that it's fine to for Jews to die on October 7th, but not for anyone else. And I think it's really a failure of our education system to teach students ethics and morals. I mean, unfortunately, I teach at a Catholic university, and ethics and world religions are the two required courses. Even if you're in the business school, you've got to take those courses and at least provide students with the education that we now think is quaint or is relegated to another century, or that basically is reading books about old white guys. I mean, that's how it's often dismissed. And I think we're understanding that there's tremendous value in that because it teaches students how to think for themselves and how to know right from wrong. And that's what's appalled me, is that people are prepared for their political beliefs to justify savagery and butchery. And that I just don't understand it. But this is also why I would argue what we saw on October 7th wasn't just an attack on Israel and wasn't just the deaths of Israelis, but it was also assault on our values in the West.
Indeed, the fastest hour in radio, especially today. For the past 26 years, Bruce Hoffman, Dr. Bruce Hoffman, our special guest, has been editor-in-chief as well of the scholarly journal Studies in Conflict and Terrorism. Bruce has also been studying terrorism and insurgency for the past 5 decades and is with Georgetown University, and Bill Witsit is with us as well. I want to point folks to the Hoffman Group, Bruce Hoffman, that's his consulting group for a lot of these publications, and there's a lot of good ones out there. I've got War on Terror, 20 years, Crossroads or Cul-de-Sac. I like that one. Something out of the Atlantic recently as well. You'll find most of these in that area, including his accredited Inside Terrorism. Bill Witsit?
Well, Bruce, thanks again. And we've got about a minute left. Any concluding thoughts that you'd like to pass along that we ought to be thinking about?
Well, I think the United States is on and has been on the right track. Of course, it was during the Trump administration that the landmark Abraham Accords were concluded and have continued to be built upon. And President Biden, especially with his efforts to make peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia, that these are all very important. And I think just as we saw 2 days after the October 7th attacks, when the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and Italy all issued a statement supporting Israel and recognizing that Israel embodies our Western democratic values, and that it's important to ensure Israel's existence and longevity. You know, we don't talk about that Russia should be destroyed or should disappear because it invaded Ukraine, for example. I mean, Israel is often subjected to a very different criteria. So I think we have to work for peace. We have to defeat terrorists, or at least weaken them to the point that they're not the kind of threat that emerged on October 7th. But then once we've achieved that military goal, diplomatically, we have to work even harder now for a resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which we were getting close to before these tragic events of 2 weeks ago, 17 days ago.
Thanks again for joining us for the podcast, and join us daily Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on local stations all across Montana.